I'm Kennedy Frugia from Pharmacy Times, and you're listening to Pharmacy Focus. The Pharmacy Times Pharmacy Focus podcast provides the latest industry news information, thought leader insight, clinical updates, patient counseling tools, and innovating solutions for the everyday practice in the business of pharmacy. On this episode of Pharmacy Focus, Assistant Managing Editor Aislinn Antrim sat down with Dr. Kristen Speer and Dr. Anais Webster-Manuvi to discuss their thought process and aim for their upcoming documentary.
To get started, kind of for the audience to just kind of know what you're working on, can you give me a little bit of like the background, just kind of the elevator pitch of your project and what you're doing?
Absolutely. One of my favorite things to do. My background is mostly in retail community pharmacy. And while I was working, I started to notice a shift during the COVID-19 pandemic. There was always things going on with pharmacy. There have been issues with workplace conditions for a very long time, as we have seen throughout our film. There's been kind of things bubbling under the surface, but it was manageable. That started to change during COVID when the basically vaccinating the country fell onto pharmacists without the requisite support to go along with it. So at first there was a lot of extra staffing, big clinics, et cetera, but then that sort of went away and shifted into, okay, the pharmacies are vaccinating the entire country without enough support to be able to do vaccinations plus filling prescriptions at the same time, which is why we say we are very pro-vaccine on this for this documentary. We want people to get vaccinated, but we want people to feel supported. And sometimes it feels like to pharmacists working, I feel like I have to just sell these vaccines, upsell them, like I feel like I'm working at a McDonald's is something that we hear. And we went with a tongue-in-cheek title because we are doing this film for the general audience. We want to meet the audience where they are, which a lot of times, unfortunately, and we want to change this perspective with our film, is the audience thinks that we are just like fast food with pills. The audience thinks that it's an errand. Not everyone, but certain people in the population, and that is unfortunately a little bit more common. So we want to meet people where they are, and we want it to be kind of funny. We want it to be humorous, because satire is a great way to draw people in so that you can subvert the expectations and then let people know pharmacy isn't fast food. Pharmacy is a lot more complex than that, and buckle up, it's gonna be a wild ride. So that's essentially how the project started. And then we started reaching out to pharmacists and technicians, and we had our social media presence, and we got tons of stories. We had hundreds of stories pouring in because pharmacists and technicians want their story told. And so those started to pour in, and we cut together something with some of the Zoom footage for fundraising purposes. We have a GoFundMe as well. And to be able to take our first few trips, we crowdfunded it. And with the Zoom footage that we got from our first calls, we took some of those stories and cut together a teaser trailer. And that's just the start. The working conditions is just the start of this project, and we want to go much deeper than that. So we start there, okay, but why? Once we get that audience buy-in, why are the working conditions like that? This? Is it just poorly run pharmacies? Is it corporate greed? Is it another factor that we don't know about? Because a lot of people in the public think, oh, this pharmacy is just run poorly. The manager's just doing a bad job, which we know is not the case in the vast majority of situations. Like everything else, that is the case in some, but not that many. That is not the most common thread. So it's deeper than that. It goes into how the reimbursement structures are structured. That's not a very eloquent way to say this. It goes into how payment is structured in pharmacy, how a lot of these pharmacists and pharmacies are losing money filling prescriptions, especially in the independent space, which is forcing them to close, which is different than the chain retail space, which is causing a lot of these staffing issues. Because if you're losing money, then there isn't the incentive to staff appropriately. And so we want to kind of peel back a lot of those layers to see this is a very complex problem that people aren't aware that's going on in pharmacy.
There are so many layers to this issue, and what the public knows and what they see, some of it being not being able to get their prescription on time, not being able to get their prescription at all, not being able to get through to the pharmacy, providers not being able to get through to the pharmacy, the main window being closed and just the drive-through open, or vice versa. All these things have a reason behind them. And for the public, the general audience, to understand these layers at a higher level is part of the goal. So that there's also maybe a push or call to action for advocacy, or you know, just kindness at the, more kindness at the counter. Help us help you, right? So there's a lot of layers, as I mentioned, and I think the goal is not only to educate the public and to expose what pharmacy is really like, but also to entertain at the same time, and ultimately drive a call to action.
And with that being said, what we like to really reinforce and drive home is this project is not the doom and gloom, we're burning pharmacy to the ground project. We get that a lot as before people get to know us in our project, but it's like they say, light, sunlight is the best disinfectant. We have to show that there are some of these issues going on before we talk about some of the hopeful things, so that it's a balance. We have to show all sides of the issues, the good, the bad, and the ugly, so that we can have a more complete picture of what's going on in pharmacy. But there is a hopeful message. We want the general public to want to fight for pharmacy, so we have to show them why pharmacists are a valuable part of your healthcare team. And to do that, we have to show this is the value that a pharmacist is bringing to your care, and to your health and to public health in general. We have to show the hopeful side as well. So you can't really leave out either side of the equation if you're going to spark change, which is why, no, we are not the doom and gloom documentary. We are the real things are happening out in the workforce. We have to expose this to the general public so that a call to action can be taken.
Something that Anais just mentioned kind of sparked a thought, and back in the day, pharmacists didn't have doctorates of pharmacy decades ago. They didn't have board certifications. And at that point, they were highly sought after for their clinical knowledge by providers and patients alike. Today, it seems like all that is flipped on its head, right? Now we are generally what people see is we are dispensing machines and just glorified cash register operators. And it seems like even if we wanted to, we still can't provide the knowledge and education of the consultation. The system's been set up that way, and it's tarnished pharmacists and pharmacies' reputation as well. Nobody really comes to seek our advice anymore. Sometimes even providers don't believe we have the knowledge that we have. We have all the education possible, and yet we are not being utilized. So it's an interesting irony and contradiction. And again, as Anais mentioned, part of our goal is to expose that and really get the general audience, the public, to understand who pharmacists are, who pharmacy technicians are, how much we know, how much we're capable of, and how we really are interested in the care of our patients, ultimately.
Kristen, you already kind of mentioned this, but you have a really interesting background with PBMs. Can you discuss a bit about that and kind of how that led you to creating this project?
There's so much detail. But what I will say is during the first 8 or 9 years of my career as a pharmacist, I worked for a very small PBM as a clinician. I provided hospice and palliative care and opioid recommendations to prescribers, providers, nurse practitioners, on how to manage their patient's complex pain and symptom at the end of life. And I eventually left because I wanted to pivot or pursue something a little bit different within the industry. So I went over to a different PBM and quickly learned that that was not the kind of work or the place for me, that there were practices that I didn't agree with. So I had to leave that company. And because of what I understand about the PBM and how they affected retail pharmacy and ultimately patients, I wanted to be able to drive part of the solution to the problem. You really can't, as Anaï said, and attributing this to our other partner, Marie, who said sunlight is the best disinfectant, you really can't work towards a solution until you expose what is going on. Taking a fair look at what is going on, all sides of the equation, and putting that on the table as best as you can. And so through this documentary, that's what I want to do, and that's how I arrived at this point.
There seems to be kind of a renewed attention on working conditions, of course, partially due to the COVID pandemic and how that exacerbated things. Obviously, these issues go back further. So can you give a bit of background on how these issues have changed over the years?
These issues do go back even decades, some would say. We've interviewed a lot of pharmacists who have been in the industry for decades, and some of these issues were seeded a long time ago with just different types of, without getting into too much detail because we could get really far into the weeds, but there's different legislation that was passed decades ago that kind of informed how we are today. There's the inability of pharmacists to charge for counseling. There's legislation that said pharmacists are required to counsel, but that was still tied to a product dispensing. And so there's those types of legislation at the federal level. Each state has different laws on the books when it comes to pharmacists being able to charge for their clinical knowledge and their clinical services, which set the incentive to be more on the dispensing side. So there's those types of issues. There's how PBMs have shifted over the last several decades from where it was, this is a gross oversimplification, but a claims adjudication service before computers. So it was making it so that you could have that real-time billing, I guess not before computers, but before the computing power that we have today. Is the more technically correct way to say that, and shifting into PBMs, how they operate today, and the contract negotiations, and some of the influencing setting prices, and the lack of regulation surrounding that industry. So all of those things go back decades. However, a lot of it, if you look at incentives, and you look at where the money is, and you look at the number of pharmacists in the marketplace, those different types of issues do influence working conditions. So if you are incentivized to not staff as well because you are not getting reimbursed as well, then you will not staff as well. However, before, if reimbursement was better, then you have more money to put into your stores and staff pharmacies appropriately. Same thing with the number of pharmacists in the economy in general. So they talk about the pharmacist shortage. I do put that in quotes for right now because there's not a pharmacist shortage. If you look at certain jobs, they get 150 plus applicants because it's in a working environment that's actually staffed appropriately. But because of that, it does shift the calculus because the narrative is, oh, there's not enough pharmacists right now. I can't find anyone. Oh, we're offering these large bonuses at a lot of these chain retail pharmacies and no one's taking them. That means there's no pharmacist. Oh no, there's no pharmacist. So it makes it look like there's a shortage, and it kind of puts some of the incentives, makes the incentives misaligned when it looks like there's a shortage, but there actually isn't, versus if you look 10, 20, 30 years ago when there actually was a shortage and they were like giving pharmacists the leverage that they needed because they literally were not enough pharmacists in the marketplace. They were able to like promote environments that they wanted to entice pharmacists to, because they're like, there's not that many pharmacists to backfill, versus now, yes, pharmacists are starting to vote with their feet and not take these jobs because of the working conditions. But at the end of the day, even 5 years ago, there was a pretty big pharmacist surplus. And so that shifts the balance of the equation to where if the incentives are misaligned to where they're not being reimbursed enough, why would they create an environment that pharmacists want to go to? There's another one in line. And so that's kind of how I will leave it at that, where it's a lot of the issues are about incentives and misaligned incentives between the pharmacy and the industry as a whole, and the pharmacists and patients and staffing safety needs.
From my perspective, simply put, yes, these working conditions go back way further. They've always been kind of an issue. Now, several decades ago, the pharmacy position, being a pharmacist, was very prestigious and glorified. There were huge sign-on bonuses. I mean, it was great to be a pharmacist in retail. And as Anais mentioned, things have slowly changed based on where things have been incentivized and other factors to ultimately just becoming more and more of a problem, where pharmacy has become understaffed, under reimbursed, under recognized. And even before COVID, this was an issue. COVID was really the straw that broke the camel's back, where it really, really hurt and brought the industry to its knees. And now I think we're seeing some of the fallout from that, where pharmacists have had enough. We're about to turn a corner with flu season and COVID shots again. And they're coming to their feet to speak out. And hopefully this is a big ship in the sea of tumultuous storms. It's finally pivoting and trying to make a difference for patients and the profession alike.
I do want to add, just because you said pharmacists are starting to vote with their feet, they're doing so by leaving positions that are not safe in their opinion and not sustainable for them, in their opinion and in reality. Like, the reality is these conditions are not safe for patients, and pharmacists are deciding to not be a part of an unsafe environment by not taking these jobs or leaving these jobs. But we also see another side of this, as we've witnessed in Kansas City, in that market, where pharmacists have, unprotected by a union, decided to have a labor action of sorts and let the public know by walking off the job that this is not safe. We're going to stand together and walk out so that we can make a stand so people know how unsafe the working conditions are. And there's a lot of different sides and opinions of that labor action. But at the end of the day, you don't get to that point because it's a really hard decision to make. You don't get to that point as a pharmacist because you're without it being something that's very dire. It has to be dire to the point of making the decision between, I am not going to take care, I'm not able to take care of my patients, whether I'm here or not. That's the real issue. It gotten to the point where they feel that even if they were there, they're not able to take care of their patients appropriately. So they might as well stand together and not be there so that they can make enough waves to help bring attention to the severity of this issue. So it's not something that's taken lightly, because we have heard some feedback, oh, what about patient abandonment? What about your patients? What about your patients? But it's like, you don't take a stand like that if it's not for your patients. Like, protecting your own self, and like they say, when you're getting on a plane, put your own mask on before helping others. You have to put your own oxygen mask on to be able to have a working environment that is safe and sustainable so that you can do your job to help your patients And if you don't have that environment, this is the reason people are taking a stand.
You've both kind of touched on these things, but I want to really specifically address them. What are the key issues that pharmacists are really kind of having enough with at this point?
You know, if we're talking outside of retail pharmacy, I can say that no matter where you work, generally speaking, if you're working within a retail setting or even a PBM environment, I can speak both of those to those both of those environments as a pharmacist are very difficult and challenging to work in.
We interviewed someone who has some information about what are called time standards. So essentially what those are there is data collected on how long it takes to pick up a pen from a certain number of centimeters away, how long it takes to walk across the pharmacy to start your counseling, how long it takes to fill a prescription, how long it takes to put a ream of paper in a printer. They have data on all of that. And if you look at that data, and then you look at the standard operating procedures of these pharmacies, there is a gap with the amount of staffing there is right now. There are not physically enough hours in the day to be able to follow all of the standard operating procedures in these pharmacies. And so if there is that gap, unfortunately, that you have to take shortcuts somewhere if they're not going to provide you with additional staffing, because there is physically not enough time to follow all of the standard operating procedures that are laid out for patient safety. So the options are you provide more staff so that you can follow those to the letter, or they end up having to take shortcuts. And so that's what we want to point out, because the data is out there. You can just look at how long it's taking people to do everything, look at what they're supposed to be doing, and see where that gap is. So there's just physically not enough time in the day to be able to do things in the way that is the most safe for patients. So that is like the crux of the issue, is there's not enough staff and there's not enough time in the day given the amount of staff in the stores, which also leads to a lot of customer and patient frustration that is taken out on the pharmacy team. So because there's not enough time and things aren't getting done, it's extremely frustrating for patients and for customers alike. And we understand that as pharmacists, that you've been waiting in this line for 45 minutes to get up to the counter for us to tell you it's not ready. That is extremely frustrating. And especially if you're coming back multiple times, or you've tried to call on the phone and no one is answering, that's frustrating for the staff as well. The phone is ringing off the hook and you can't answer it. That's frustrating on both ends. And then that patient frustration is taken out on the staff, sometimes in very hostile and can be violent ways. There is violence that is like being thrown at the staff. Like one of the people we interviewed, they left pharmacy because someone said they were going to come back with a gun because the refill wasn't done. If I come back with my gun, my refill be ready? That's the kind of stuff that's happening. And we hear stories of being robbed at gunpoint. People can't eat. People can't go to the bathroom. Like basic human and labor rights are being violated. These are things we fought for as a country in the early 20th century, and we're still having these same issues in pharmacy today. So I could go on for a long time. I won't, but that is the crux of the issue. There isn't enough time in the day. There isn't enough staff. And because of that, the frustration is compounding from the patients, and it's being taken out on the pharmacy staff.
And corporate keeps adding more metrics.
How did the COVID-19 pandemic really exacerbate these pre-existing problems?
Prescriptions didn't go away in COVID. You still say you do a store that does 500 prescriptions in a day. Those 500 prescriptions didn't go anywhere. And now you have 100 vaccine appointments. For example, we spoke to someone who said, oh, at the pharmacy, the chain pharmacy I work at, the appointment slots are every 15 minutes, but those appointments can be booked by families. And it doesn't account for how many vaccines each person is getting. So most people come in at least couples, if not four people. So coming with their partners and their children. So you have 2 to 4 people every 15 minutes. And a lot of these people are getting COVID, flu, RSV, and Prevnar 20 all together because they're like, why wouldn't I? I'm here. I might as well get all four shots. None of that is accounted for in the scheduling. So now you're super behind. And they also tend to double book appointments, double book, triple book, because it's like an airline. They don't want to be undersold, so they oversell. And then you have multiple, and people want these vaccines. So everyone is showing up for their appointment, and it's multiple people in an appointment. And so now you are in the vaccination room, and maybe you have an immunizing technician, maybe you have no technician, who knows, but the pharmacist, the buck stopped at the pharmacist for all of the work. So they have to be the final check on all of the prescriptions and counsel the patients. So if you are giving immunizations, if you're giving the vaccines, you are not checking prescriptions, that work is piling up, and then you have to go back and check those prescriptions. Or if people are standing in line to be counseled, by law and by practice and safety, and you should be counseling your patients, then everything is getting delayed because you have this additional workload.
And I'll add too, there's COVID testing through the drive-through. And so now you have to give vaccines. Your techs or you as a pharmacist have to go to the window constantly to test. And now with test to treat coming out, there's more demand for that. I know a lot of people are applauding the ability of pharmacists to test to treat. And yes, there's a lot of good surrounding that. We're using our skills, our expertise, we're providing patient care. On the other hand, it's just adding more to an impossible day. And it's that really feels like you're being caught between a rock and a hard place. And on top of that, when flu and COVID come around, oftentimes pharmacies are staffed with just one pharmacist or maybe one or two technicians. So if you're sick, you're not feeling well, you're still oftentimes, most of the times, forced to come in because there's no backup. There's no one else staffed. So you're working and feeling like crud. You're getting your staff sick. You're potentially getting your patients sick. And it's just a negative spiral from there. There's so many demands and not enough resources and backup to help you do your job safely and effectively.
Let us do those services. Give us staff to do those services. We're not saying don't do the services. We're just saying give pharmacies additional staff, which means reimburse pharmacies for these services so that they can afford the staff.
Right. And also provider billing. So when provider status comes, there will be direct reimbursement from insurances, which that's important because it carves out the time. It protects the time for pharmacists to be able to provide those services.
How do concerns about PBM behavior really play into these issues? I know you've talked about that as well, but kind of how do those issues link up?
Right. So one of the primary ways, there's a few, but one of the primary, there's actually more than a few, but we don't have time for all that. So one of the primary ways is that PBMs are known to under reimburse pharmacies for their drugs. So for example, if you're a pharmacy and you buy a drug for $5 for 30 pills, for example, that's the cost of that drug. That's how much you paid for it as a pharmacy. But then a lot of times PBMs will come back and reimburse a pharmacy for less than that, some amount less, maybe $4, maybe $1, whatever that is in the contracted price. So what happens is if you don't even get paid the amount back, let alone some margin or something on top of that to keep your doors open, you really can't afford to staff, keep the lights on, and do all the other things that you need to do as a pharmacy business. So therefore, a lot of folks who own pharmacies even say pharmacy is not a business, because you lose money on those prescriptions. Who would sell a chicken casserole at a restaurant for less than the cost to make it, right? So that's one way. Another way is PBMs are often the cause of a lot of administrative burden on the pharmacist. So what could or should be more of an automated process? Yes, a lot of it is automated, including claims adjudication. But what should be a fairly streamlined process is not. For example, if the PBM and the employer, a patient's employer, has decided that they want to require a prior authorization for a particular high-cost medication, then that patient is going to experience a rejection at the pharmacy, or just a rejection, whether they're at the pharmacy or not, which holds up a prescription. And there's a lot of opinions and controversy about whether that's a really a value-based procedure, right, or activity. Is that prior authorization really getting at whether that's the best drug for that patient? Is it really driving patients to an equivalent drug that's less costly, or a more effective drug that's less costly? Or is this a nuisance? Is it an unnecessary task that wastes time and dollars and creates a lot of headache? So pharmacists and technicians are often on the on one end of that, trying to handle claims rejections, calling the PBM for overrides, and often battling with patients on, you know, why their medication is not ready and what alternatives might be covered by the PBM or by the employer for the employer's decision. So all these things contribute to what is often a very difficult working environment for pharmacies and pharmacists and the staff there that are directly related to the PBM.
I'll just echo as far as that administrative burden. There's also, in a lot of these pharmacies, yes, there may be a third party rejection queue, which you can look at, okay, how many insurance claims haven't gone through, but that's a very manual process. And if you're behind, a lot of times you don't have a chance to look at that queue until the patient is right in front of you and then frustrated. And every frustrated patient interaction is, it feels like it's 10 times longer than if they are not frustrated, because a lot of your time is spent getting the patient to kind of de-escalating the patient first, then taking care of the issue. If they don't de-escalate and you're the pharmacy technician, then you're pulling in the pharmacist to help you de-escalate. And then that pulls the pharmacist away from their other tasks. And so it's just a cascading effect. That's one thing I'll add. And then how PBMs are involved in setting a lot of the prices, and it's confusing. So a lot of it's very confusing to both patients and pharmacists alike, because if you work for a large chain retail pharmacy, you don't see a lot of these numbers like an independent pharmacy would. So an independent pharmacy, they know all of the data, they have their hands in it because they're running their own business. If you are a chain retail pharmacist, for example, when I was practicing in that setting, I didn't see any of the numbers. So I really didn't have answers for patients when they were like, why is my prescription this expensive? I have no idea, because I don't see any of the reimbursement. I don't see any of that. So I don't know, call your insurance company. But even if you do, the layers of complexity are so much that you're like, I don't know how to explain this to someone who is not in the business anyway, because I won't get into too far in the weeds because we could get super far in the weeds with pricing, but the pricing isn't transparent. And so then if you are the pharmacist who is like, I'm trying to explain to my patient why they're paying so much and make them understand so they're not frustrated and thinking the pharmacy is the one charging them that, because a lot of times people think, oh, the pharmacy is charging me this much, when they're not, unless it's a non-insurance claim drug. But then even that is affected by PBMs, because a lot of times pharmacies will set their prices based on the PBM contracts, because they're like, oh, we know it'll my quote cash price affects my reimbursement, so I have to set my cash price at a certain level. But again, as a chain retail pharmacist in the community, you don't know what any of those numbers are or see that. So it's just a lot of confusion.
DIR fees in particular, our major concerns are always a topic of discussion. So what are those specific effects and how have you seen that issue kind of change and evolve over the years?
That's a great question. And even myself, who has worked in PBM, I'm probably not 100% accurate on the details, but what I can tell you is that DIR fees are, they stand for direct and indirect remuneration fees. And basically what happens is at the end of the year, there's certain metrics that the pharmacy needs to meet. And if the pharmacy doesn't meet those requirements, then the PBM can come back and recoup some fees from the pharmacy at the end of the year for not meeting those specific criteria or requirements. And it's a large sum of money for a lot of pharmacies. So much so that these DIR fees are often a contributor to making a community pharmacy or independent pharmacy go out of business. And that's what we may see actually at the turn of this new year in 2024. But I'll defer to Anais to explain a little bit more about some of the changes that are coming.
Yes. Again, likewise, I don't have exact specification details, but from what we have, from what we've understood from our independent pharmacy folks that we have interviewed throughout this documentary process, here's what is happening. I'll use an example. For example, adherence is a big issue and it makes sense. So that's the thing with metrics. A lot of them are coming from a good place. You want your patient to take the medication, right? And so 80% is the number that they want your pharmacy to be at for certain medications. So you have certain medications you have to be at 80% adherence for. And if your pharmacy overall is not at that 80%, then that's when you get a DIR fee, like ding. And there's other metrics that you would get dinged on, but that doesn't take into consideration like a lot of other factors going on. So for example, if we look at the patient level for adherence, they don't necessarily care as the insurance company if the patient changes therapy. So say, like for example, statins are one. Say a patient has a statin, they end up being intolerant to like all the statins that they tried. So they are using a completely different type of medication, or they've just the therapy isn't appropriate for them, so they're doing something else. But then for a diabetic patient, you're going to get, well, they're supposed to be on this 80% of the time, they're prescribed this, why aren't they picking it up? So that's an example. Or say a patient is in the hospital for a significant portion of the year, then they're not picking it up at their pharmacy, it's being filled through the hospital, but it's still dropping their adherence.
A lot of patients get samples too from their provider on a regular basis.
Samples, people pay out of pocket. People go, oh, it's cheaper than my copay, so I'm just gonna buy this for $10 rather than $25. So there's a lot of reasons people may look not adherent, even though they are, but the insurance company doesn't necessarily take that into consideration. And then if you're looking across all your patients, it's not looking at factors such as what type of area is this pharmacy in? Are you in an area that is a lower socioeconomic status and patients are having trouble affording their medications and they're making the trade-off between eating and affording their medications? Or they're not able to get into the pharmacy on time every month. Maybe they only get in so that they're able to take their medication 70% of the time, but then the pharmacy is getting dinged for that. And a lot of these rural independent pharmacies are in that boat, which is why they're getting hit with these fees. We've also heard that there's one person, an attorney that we talked to, that said, as he's collected data, some of these contracts aren't even, like the chain retail pharmacies may have a different contract language when it comes to some of the metrics that are being enforced versus the independent pharmacies. So they're getting judged more harshly. That is what we have heard from some of the interviews that we have done. And so they're getting judged more harshly. They may have an area that's a lower socioeconomic status, so it's harder for people to fill their prescriptions, but none of this is being taken into consideration. And so at the end of the year, you may get hit with $150,000 bill. And so you have to be prepared for an indeterminate amount to be taken, what is called clawed back, to the insurance company. And so they just kind of have to hope they have enough cash, and they do things to make sure that they have the cash flow. However, it's kind of like a win with an unintended consequence. So there's new legislation that says these fees are not fair, and so you shouldn't be clawing back fees at the end of the year. And so it's now shifting, and I'm probably going to get the exact details wrong. I have to go back through our interviews to get the details, but from what I understand is it's now going to the point of sale. And so now all these pharmacies are going to have a bunch of cash taken out of their cash flow, out of their bank.
Reserves, yeah.
Reserves, yes. Taken out of their reserves at the end of the year for 2023. And then in the beginning of 2024, first quarter, they're going to get a bill then as well. And so those reserves are gone. And so a lot of independent pharmacies have called this the DIR apocalypse, because a lot of pharmacies are not prepared because there's no way for them to have that much money that early in the year, given that their reserves are depleted. So a lot of these pharmacies may go out of business early in 2024. So more to come on that. We'll see what that looks like. And also pharmacies don't necessarily sign the contracts themselves. A lot of them, I don't know what PSAO stands for, but it's like a negotiating group that signs the contract on your behalf, because who is an independent pharmacy owner is going to have leverage and power and time to negotiate with every single PBM.
They really don't know what they're getting into, because they're not actually the ones signing the dotted line.
That's another catch with the PBM stuff is, say it's an all or nothing contract. They're like, this is your contract. You can either have Express Scripts or not. And if you don't take them, could be up to a third of your people or more. And so then you're losing a lot of your customer base. So they're like, sorry, do you want our customer base or not? Do you want these patients or not? And so people are okay with taking these contracts through their PSAO, because they're like, well, we're going to lose a lot of patients if we don't. And there's no negotiation. There's no room for negotiation in these contracts. That's maybe not 100% accurate. I think there's things you can do through your PSAO, but not really, not that much.
For the audience, PSAO is a pharmacy services administrative organization. To be specific about the details, they negotiate, I'm looking this up right now, they negotiate pharmacy network contracts and perform many core back office operations for their pharmacies. Mm-hmm. See, even we have to look this stuff up.
That's why a lot of this stuff, like, we're doing what we can off the top of our heads, but also a lot of it is going to be, this is just an aside about like documentary process. We have hundreds of hours of footage, and that we haven't even filmed everyone we want to. And so it's just a lot of like combing back through expert footage, because we're not the experts. That's why we're doing a documentary, because there's more experts out there than us. And so we want to go talk to them. And in the film itself, it'll be people speaking on their own behalf on the topics that they're an expert in.
There has been quite a bit more kind of legislative attention on PBMs in recent years, particularly at the state level. Have you seen any real movement on the issue, or has it all been those things where it's kind of like, this seems like a win, but there's a catch? Kind of, what are your feelings on the latest things?
Really high level, I can say that there's a lot of activity. However, even coming from inside a PBM, it's confusing. It's really hard to keep track of, because there are so much activity going on as far as PBM regulation at the local level, state level. I think we will see some movement, but maybe it's not very perceptible right now. Movement being, you know, better outcomes for patients and for the healthcare system and people who pay for it. I'm not sure I see any perceptible change locally when it comes to regulating PBMs. But there is some activity at the federal level that I think could make some serious waves.
To kind of expand on that, yeah, the FTC is looking into it. There's lots of bills being brought to Congress about it. That is one area in our film that we are still seeking out. We would love to talk to representatives who are drafting some of those bills. So if anyone listening has contacts with any representatives or the FTC, et cetera, send them our way. We would love to talk to them. But yes, there's a lot going on, and the government isn't necessarily fast. So I don't know how else to put that, but it's just, these things take time. Laws take time to change and enforce. And then I know some of the winds are coming from not the new legislation that's being passed, because it'll take longer for that to come into effect, but actually enforcing the laws that are on the books is an easier way. And that's what the FTC is looking at now. They're looking at the current antitrust laws, and they're saying, okay, let's actually enforce the laws that are on the books alongside of creating new legislation to enforce.
Yeah, a lot of states are looking very closely at anti-steering. So, you know, for example, I can't give any specific states off the top of my head, but I know that there are anti-steering laws that PBMs have to follow in specific states, meaning that they can't drive patients to their own pharmacies or mail order pharmacy. They have to allow and communicate clearly that flexibility to patients, that they can use any pharmacy that they want to. So that's one example of local regulation that we're seeing some movement in. And there are others too. And I will say that, you know, PBMs, I can say from personal experience working inside a PBM that they are interested in following the law and being compliant. So it'll be interesting to see how things move in that direction, and also at the federal level.
Mail order is a big part to talk about, because mail order is like, there is a place for mail order and there's a time and a place. It's just PBMs are often saying to patients, you have to use our mail order pharmacy for your continuing maintenance medications or for your specialty medications, which are like, it, when you really dig into the definition of specialty, what is a specialty drug anyway? But they are saying you have to use the pharmacy that is owned by the PBM. And patients don't know they have any other options. So there's that. A lot of times they don't find that out until you are standing at the counter and you adjudicate the claim. And it's like, sorry, you have to use mail order. And that's when you find that out. And so then, again, patient frustration, but then you don't even end up filling that prescription for the patient. And so that is another part of the equation, is there's also kind of trying to get the prescriptions kind of in their own channels, which takes less than there. You have less revenue and traffic, et cetera, going to the stores, because they're not in the store buying stuff in the rest of the store, because a lot of times these stores make their money not in the pharmacy per se. They make some money back there, but not as much as them being in the store to buy over-the-counter products or other things sold.
How are pharmacists kind of handling all of these things and really advocating for change? I mean, obviously they're handling them by walking out or doing other similar things, but kind of what are you seeing from all the people you've been talking to?
As far as advocating for change goes, it's different. Like, different people have different levels of bandwidth and leverage, ability, etc. So from our vantage, just kind of looking from it, from the people we've talked to, and like a more like documentary perspective, just looking at people, there's different ways you can advocate for yourself. So there's some people, if you are so burnt out, you go home and you are so depressed you can't even turn on the TV and you stare at a blank screen until your shift starts the next day, you don't have the capacity to be able to advocate for yourself. So the best advocacy you can do is take care of yourself and probably leave that job so that you can actually like be a person. But then there's also other channels for advocacy. People are speaking out on social media. I know some organizations are like, oh, all you're doing is, all people are doing are complaining on social media, but that's part of the conversation. Sometimes enough voices being gathered together to say that this is an issue and, hey, oh, are you having this issue too? Are you having this issue too? Because this documentary started in part because of all of the waves that were being made on social media and seeing that, oh, this is all over the country. And so knowing it's not just your individual location, it's not just your individual store. So there's just getting your collective voices together. There's some people are joining pharmacy organizations at the state or national level. Joining those organizations, that is an option for people. And there's, we hear both sides of it. We hear people saying, I will just come out and say it. We hear people say, why would I do that? They're not, quote, doing anything for me. But we've also heard from the organizational side, if no one joins this organization, we don't have any leverage. We can't do anything if no one joins. And so it's kind of this rock and hard place with pharmacy organizations. And we have heard both sides of it. And I'll kind of leave it at that. For those organizations, people are writing their congressmen. People are trying to get legislators involved, either through an organization or on their own, is something people are doing. People are writing their boards of pharmacy about working conditions and letting them know what's going on and getting involved that way. Those are the big ones as far as involvement and what people are up to. And some people are just going out on their own, putting their own shingle out there and just becoming an entrepreneur and saying, I'm going to revolutionize pharmacy this way. So there's lots of different options for how people want to get involved with advocacy, depending on a lot of factors.
I'll add too that pharmacists and pharmacy workers are exhausted. Anais touched on this, and sometimes just taking, like she said, taking care of yourself is the best reaction. And then those who have the bandwidth that can advocate for change or put out acute fires so the pharmacists who are exhausted can take a deep breath and start advocating themselves. I think that's where we see a lot of effort right now.
CVS agreed to increase staffing after pharmacists walked off the job. Do you see that as a real step forward, and how can that momentum be maintained?
I think that it could be a real step forward. I think a lot of people are skeptical and waiting to see what happens. Was this just something for show, a demonstration, or is this something that CVS and other retail chains are truly interested in changing? I think that, you know, this also highlights, and I think what I'm about to say really applies to any kind of situation where employees don't feel heard, you know, the strikes in the automobile industry and in Hollywood, that sometimes corporations, and this is totally my opinion, but I feel like sometimes corporations get so big that their head is literally detached from the rest of their body. They're so disconnected from what's going on the ground and what they're doing with their arms and their hands, that they don't recognize that the foundation is cracking. They don't recognize that their body is in poor health. They're so focused on where their head is at, being high up, that it's easy to ignore, whether it's intentionally or unintentionally, or just not be aware of what is going on at the ground level and keeping those people who literally run your company at the bottom happy. And I think this is kind of a wake-up call for not only CVS, but other chains and even under other industries. I mean, it's almost like we're going through a season of strikes right now, right? And I learned in the news that, you know, maybe Kaiser Permanente will have a major strike next week or in the upcoming weeks. So I don't think this is the last of what we're going to see, but I definitely think that the real movement is maybe not within pharmacy so much immediately, but a wake-up call to people at the top.
I think Kristen stated that very well. And I think the only thing I will add is we'll see and time will tell.
Well, kind of circling back to your documentary specifically, where does it currently stand? What, you know, can people get involved? You know, what would you like people to know about it at this point?
We are currently doing a big fundraising push. So there are a few ways to get involved. If you are able to contribute financially, looking to really push hard on the fundraising side so we can get back into production. So we've taken a few trips, but we have several more slated once we get funded for that. If you aren't able to contribute financially at this time, then please share your story. So you are just like, wow, I have a story to tell about pharmacy. If you are a patient, pharmacist, associated with pharmacy in any way, and these issues are impacting you, please fill out one of those forms. And it can be anonymous or identified. We understand that people might not feel comfortable reaching out with their name attached. The form does have options for remaining anonymous if you would like to do so. So those are the best ways you can get involved and you can help us. And we're in it for the long haul. Please follow us on social media. And also another plug, we are writing a book alongside the film. I almost forgot to mention that. The book is very important because we know all of this won't fit in the film. So we are also putting together a book proposal so that we can pitch it to the agents and hopefully get a book deal picked up as well. And those types of agencies like to see really involved, a really involved social media presence. And so the more people who follow along and are interested in this project, the easier it will be for us to get that book deal. So.
And I will add that we are turning a very exciting corner too, as far as our documentary film goes. We have brought on a consulting producer from Hollywood and a director producer with who has direct ties to Hollywood, award-winning folks. So this is real. This is definitely happening. We're gaining a lot of momentum and recognition from folks who are very inspired by this story for many reasons. So I just want to put that out there. And also that us three ladies, women, mothers, are not earning any income on this. So it's very much a passion project of ours, and we are all in it. We're all for it. We're all in it. We work on it every single day. We're constantly talking with our producers, a director, Anais is currently director and maybe co-direct with our new director. But nonetheless, we're excited about this project. And again, a very exciting corner we're about to turn as far as our project stands currently.
Is there anything you want to add? Anything that, you know, I didn't ask about? Anything to touch on?
Yeah, I think I will add something that is probably one of the more important points I want to make. And that is that I alluded to this earlier, but it's very easy to point fingers at what's going wrong, who's to blame, what the sources of these problems are, especially from the outside, an outsider looking in, right? We do have a lot of experts in the field, but there's expertise and knowledge that's locked up on the inside of the problem. Folks who are afraid to speak out due to retaliation, who know that if they shared that information, could potentially offer a solution, one of many solutions to this big problem that is pharmacy and healthcare right now. So I think what I want to say is, as we produce this film and this documentary, we're also very much eager to get the other side of the story, the inside of corporate pharmacy, the inside of PBMs, because really through putting all perspectives, more complete information on the table for all to see, we can find a solution that will really work. I think that's really important. For example, when it comes to mail order, as we spoke about a little bit earlier in this interview, a lot of patients are confused. They feel like they're not receiving mail order communication. I happen to know that Also, PBMs make an effort to communicate to patients about proactively about whether or not they can receive a medication via mail order, or whether or not they can receive their medication that now has to have a prior authorization. What alternatives are available? There are entire departments dedicated to mailing, proactively mailing members and patients information about this. But nobody's hearing this part of the story. And I think it's critical. Are these the pieces that we need to amplify? Are these the pieces that maybe others need to take hold of and say, actually, that's a good move. And let's do more of that. How can we pull together resources to make these positive things more of a reality, more of a widespread practice within the industry? Because they're positive, right? A lot of folks don't realize that PBMs are implementing decisions of the employer. So it was through agreement with the PBM, for example, that the employer decided they want to put a prior authorization because they believe they're saving this much money on that specialty medication. So it's oftentimes the employer's decision in partnership with our PBM. I know a lot of folks are listening to this and might be saying, that's a bunch of baloney. The PBM, you know, is trying to get employers to, you know, is pushing employers into those decisions. And I say, well, maybe, or maybe not. Are they really? And can we ask those questions and put that information on the table so that we can all move forward towards a solution? See what's working, see what's not. And I think that's a critical piece of this documentary that our entire team aiming for. We want to tell the whole story.
So if you're listening and you are high up in one of these corporations or PBMs and our doors open, please reach out. We would love to talk to you.